You're listening to The Impromptu on the Hologram Radio Network, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. I'm Alex Knight, and I'm joined by VP of Chaos Management, Michael Norton. How are you, Michael?
Very good. Keeping things random. Holds up Spork.
What's going on this week? There's actually quite a bit to talk about.
Yeah, quite a lot. Lots of Apple stuff. Lots and lots of Apple stuff.
Well, why don't we start there? What's going on with Apple? I know iOS 9.3 is a public beta. Well, is it a public beta yet?
Yes, or they just... it did hit public beta.
Okay.
So in a somewhat unprecedented step, Apple announced an iOS update on their site. iOS 9.3, they created an entire page dedicated to it, which is unusual for a minor point release.
And for a minor point release, contains actually quite a bit of new functionality,
yes.
Which is surprising.
Yes, it does. So one of the main tentpole features in 9.3 is on 64-bit devices only, there's a new feature called Night Shift, which tweaks the temperature of the screen at nighttime to be warmer. So it's kind of like the app Flux, which is available on Mac. The idea being that blue light makes it harder for you to sleep at night. So by tweaking the color temperature, you can still look at the screen late at night and
yeah.
Not have trouble sleeping, in theory. So now this is a system level feature of iOS, and you can enable it with either an automatic timer that activates it at sunset, deactivates it at sunrise, or you can set up a custom schedule and have it turn on and off whenever you want it to. I haven't delved too far into that particular setting, but I would imagine it actually... Let me do it right now.
So I guess because this is a system level thing, app developers won't need to do anything. It'll just change the display.
Yeah. There it is.
So actually, I guess this basically negates the need for app developers to build their own custom dark modes. Or do you? Dark mode's a different. It is a different
thing.
This
is what it looks like.
Okay. Okay, so I'm looking for those, because this is an audio-only podcast. Michael is holding his iPhone up, and the screen looks like a lovely, lovely orange hue to it. So I can see why that would be easier on the eyes at night. But I guess a dark mode is different, though, because a dark mode is still better if you're in complete darkness.
Yes.
Or I guess that's also debatable too, though, because those studies don't really go into that a lot. There seems to be more information about how the color tone affects you, but not the... maybe I'm getting this wrong. I'm actually just going to shut up because I actually don't know enough about it. This is something that the ATP podcast guys talked about a little bit, how it seems to be somewhat questionable with some of the scientific information that's being released right now. There's still not a lot of information, but it's definitely something that people are researching because I definitely think there's something to that, because I think there are two components to it. There's the, do we know for a fact that the brightness alone impacts our sleep quality? Because there seem to be two separate things for me: the brightness and then the actual color of the display itself. And obviously people are now saying that the blue light is the problem.
On the actual preview page it says, many studies have shown that exposure to bright blue light in the evening can affect your circadian rhythm and make it harder to fall asleep. So I mean, it's hard to know 100% definitively what variables can affect your sleep pattern. Studies have shown, indeed, that blue light is a problem, but screen brightness could also be a factor. It's not necessarily the temperature of the screen. It could also be the glare. I don't think they've done enough studies to really be able to conclusively say, these are the things that will keep you awake. These are the things that will allow you to still look at a screen and be fine.
Well, I think it's definitely a good start with the research that they have, but I think, you know, it's going to be years before we have anything more conclusive. Like they need to do extensive sleep studies with not just like 100 people, but they need to do like how does it affect tens of thousands of people? Like we need that data.
There essentially needs to be a long-term study about how technology affects sleep, because we've only had this stuff for about 20 years. So it's really hard to say what kind of long-term impact it has. And until a long-term study is done, we won't really know for sure. So all we have is the data that we have, which is short-term and not 100% conclusive. But it at least gives us an idea of, well, this is definitely bad for you, so we can do things to curb that. But as for long-term effects and other unknown variables, it's hard to say. So that's one of the features. Then they also upgraded Notes. Notes you can now lock with a password and then optionally enable Touch ID so that only you can look at your notes.
Touch ID is one of those things where it's so incredibly useful, but there are certain things in iOS, there are certain areas that it just seems like need some level of polish. Like, for example, why do I get prompted to enter a password when I'm editing my Apple ID? You know, there are certain areas where you don't get prompted for Touch ID, and not all apps support Touch ID for in-app purchases, which is annoying.
I feel like Apple's trying to balance convenience with security. I think it's one of those things where they look at it and go, well, buying something is something you do all the time. So it's like, whatever. You have to have your phone with you anyways. But direct access to your account, like the stuff you really don't want someone to get their hands on, they say, well, we could add Touch ID to this, but it would ultimately be more secure if we made the user type in their password.
I don't see how that would be more secure, because the whole point is with Touch ID is that you have a password and then a thumbprint on top of that.
Sure. But
so wouldn't it be more secure having that layer with Touch ID?
Well, the thing is, touch recognition is not inherently secure. You can copy someone's fingerprint if you really want to. It's easier than getting a password off of someone if they've got a really complex password.
Sure. I see what you're saying, but I'm not sure I really buy that's the reason why it's not available in every single spot of the OS. Because
look at it this way. It's really easy to implement. They've got an API for it. Anyone can add it to anything. So why did they choose not to add it to that? Because it was a deliberate decision on their part.
I mean, yeah, this is just conjecture. It could be.
I know.
It could be deliberate, or it could be that they just haven't got around to it yet. Maybe iOS 10 will have Touch ID in it.
It's honestly possible. I mean, Touch ID is fairly new. It hasn't been around a long time, so it's possible that they could be looking at adding it to more things.
I mean, there are certain things like, okay, so if in iOS, if you go to preferences and then go to the App Store section, if you want to, say, view your Apple ID account settings, it kicks you out to a browser with a really crappy experience. Like, why isn't that just built into, why isn't that natively in the OS? Like, why can't I view my Apple ID account information, like, natively in iOS, as opposed to using a web view to look at it, which is really suboptimal? Like, that kind of stuff, like, it's doable. They can fix this. They just haven't done. Obviously, there are other priorities that they need to do. And I'm not trying to belittle their work, because obviously there are more important things than that, but certainly there are little inconveniences that are annoying. I don't want to derail the conversation from iOS too much, but I just noticed today when I reinstalled OS 10, why does it ask? It asked me for my Apple ID when you first go through the setup procedure, But then when you open the App Store, or actually when you open iTunes, it asks for your Apple ID again. It's like, I just entered it. Make that part of the onboarding process. Make me enter it once and that's it. Why would you make someone log into their Apple ID like in a separate app? Like, it makes no sense.
Yeah, I think a lot of these things are low-hanging fruit that they'll get to eventually. It's like certain things that they've done on iOS, they haven't done on OS X, and they need to really take a look at those things. I mean, they've done a lot of work on bringing iOS improvements to OS X, but they certainly haven't gone far enough, I would say.
It's one of those things too, and I don't know if I really sincerely hope that with OS 10. What are we?
12.
We're at 10. Yeah, so 10.12. I hope that they continue this trend of ensuring, you know, they're doing these iterative releases and they're doing these bug fixes and performance improvements. Not to say that they should stop adding new features, because obviously people want new features, but I just hope that they start cleaning up shop a little bit and get to these little areas of inconvenience that need to be addressed.
I think what we've started seeing from Apple is they are going back and addressing these things. iOS 9 was essentially a bug fix release for iOS 8. They did add a ton of stuff, but ultimately it's a far more stable version of iOS 8. And 9.3, so far from what I've seen, is probably the most stable version of iOS in a long time. I haven't noticed any real problems, and my battery life seems to have actually improved.
Really? And you're running a beta, and it's
pretty stable. On average use, I seem to have gained about 10 to 15%. Like, on my commute home, when I get to where I'm going, when I get home, my battery is about 10 to 15% higher than it used to be.
I wonder what magic they've done.
I don't know. Could just be my experience, but they've done something, it seems.
I wonder if it has anything.
It could be night shift, maybe. I'm not sure. Like, maybe lowering raising the screen
temperature.
I'm
almost wondering if they're maybe rewriting or optimizing certain portions of the iOS code itself in Swift, which would improve things.
So there has been some apocryphal information about that. And supposedly, Apple hasn't done a ton of work, at least not where the default apps are concerned. Yeah. The default apps still haven't been rewritten in Swift, but...
Well, nobody likes refactor. Well, that's debatable, because it could be a pain in the butt.
That could be because they're focusing on rebuilding the core architecture in Swift. I'm not sure. Ultimately, at some point, iOS will be written in Swift, and the default apps will be written in Swift, and that'll give us a huge boost in performance and energy efficiency, just by virtue of how fast the compiler is and how fast the rendered code runs compared to Objective-C. But I'm not sure how long it'll take to get to 100% coverage. There's a lot of legacy stuff. Obviously, Apple isn't a company that just sits on legacy stuff and goes, well, this is the way things have been, we'll just keep it this way. They won't do that. Swift is essentially the once and future Apple language. It will be the programming language that's used for all future Apple development. And with Swift 3 coming out, they've got a roadmap for it on their GitHub. They've basically outlined exactly what they're going to do with it. And that'll be out with iOS 10 and OS 10 10.12. And it basically marks, I would say, the maturity of the language. They've cleaned up most of the issues. They've added a ton of helpful things. It'll really be the point where you could essentially replace Objective-C with Swift, and it wouldn't be any harder. In fact, just from how the syntax works, it'll be a lot easier to develop things. But yeah, it depends what Apple's timeline is on that. The new music notes app certainly isn't written in Swift, but that could just be because the team has been working on it for a while.
the music app, I mean, when they remade that app.
I'm not talking about music. I'm talking about the new Music Notes app.
Oh, the that new they music, launched. Right, okay.
Yeah. So that's another thing they've done. It's pretty cool. You can actually, it's got a built-in tuner.
I downloaded it, but I haven't actually tried it yet.
Yeah, it's pretty neat, and it ties directly into GarageBand, so that's nice. So you can just like record like strumming on a guitar. It actually identifies the notes that you're playing. Yeah, it's pretty neat, but it's not written in Swift, so I'm not sure what that means. But I guess we'll find out at WWDC where things are going. Like if we get the code dump of iOS 10 and iOS 10 10.12, and we look into the apps and we see a ton of Swift, then we'll know where things are going. If it's still all Objective-C, then things are a little murky. But I would bet we're going to see at least some evolution on that front. Maybe not as much as there should be, but we'll probably right. see a good chunk of things rewritten.
Yeah. So the night mode stuff, I guess, is that the biggest thing worth talking about? Seems to be that's what most people are interested in.
I think it's the biggest iPhone feature. They also updated the health app. So different health tracking categories now have a slider at the bottom that show apps that can track those things. So if you look at sleep, it'll give you a list of apps that track sleep. So that can be kind of helpful if you have an Apple Watch that just tracks steps and heart rate and stuff, but you need to track a few other things. It gives you options. And finally, air quotes, the health app now has a widget for the Apple Watch activity glance. So you can now see your move, exercise, and stand ratings for the day, the week, the month, the year.
And our national nightmare is over because PDFs now sync with iBooks and
yes,
iCloud.
That is the other.
I always found that extremely
surprise feature.
Like, why isn't this showing up on my other device?
Yeah, it's been a long time coming, and I think it speaks to a potential improvement in iOS 10. I think it might be an indicator that they're looking to expand iCloud Drive to be more of a file system for iOS, because that was like the last remaining low-hanging fruit in terms of grabbing documents and saving them.
Right.
Because you could open PDFs.
Where are you going with this? Are you saying that this might be one of the reasons why they haven't moved from a 16 gig iPhone? Because they're going to be offloading more and more things to iCloud?
It's a possibility. It's definitely a possibility. It seems unlikely right now with the current storage limits.
Do you think they're going to go get another year with 5 gigabytes of free storage?
I cannot see
that happening.
If they actually go to iCloud Drive as a storage system, as a file system for iOS, I don't see them sticking with 5 gig, especially if the iPhone 7 has that new camera array. Because if you're shooting DSLR quality photos at 12 megapixel, yeah. You're going to run out of space in about 10 minutes.
You would, but it actually makes me question. Now, I know last year I said the same exact thing. There's no way they're going to stick with 5 gigs of... Yeah, and they did. But anyways, I'm not going to get my hopes up. But speaking of file system stuff, I was actually just thinking, you know, with OS X, why don't we have... You know, if we did actually have better integration with iCloud, why couldn't Apple start storing other pieces of the OS in iCloud? Like, why wouldn't your app preferences be stored in iCloud Drive and other types of data that you would want to sync between?
That's something I think they're probably going to add at some point. Like,
I mean,
basically,
didn't Mobile Me originally have a feature where you could sync like app preferences or something? Like, I thought I remember like plist files got synced or something,
maybe.
But then they got rid of that.
Yeah, I could honestly see them announcing we've added backups. We now have iCloud backups for Mac. It'll probably be branded under Time Machine, or not. They might just call it backups, like the iOS backup.
And make it free. Just make it like, everyone like 100 gigabytes or a couple hundred gigabytes.
It'll be free. Because
the thing with Time Machine is that you only need to keep the most recent, like let's say six to 12 months of recent backups and then delete the rest.
The thing with the backups is they're not going to store third-party apps that you've installed yourself. They're not going to back up actual app data. They're probably not going to back up tons and tons of documents. What I think they're going to do is they're going to say, okay, we store your preferences, your Mac App Store preferences, your Mac App Store app preferences, and a few other like little configuration things, and the list of Mac App Store apps that you have installed. That all gets backed up. Then the next time you reformat your Mac or you get a new Mac, you sign in with your Apple ID, instantly, all of your preferred settings, all of your previously installed Mac App Store apps will install right in the background as you're running it. So you just type in your ID, you log in, bam, it starts changing everything to how it was before, basically. It could even save wallpaper, but iOS doesn't even do that, so maybe not that, but I could see them adding kind of a basic backup feature that saves all of your preferences and all of your Mac App Store stuff. Obviously, third-party apps are outside of their control, so they wouldn't count. So you'd have to reinstall Creative Cloud and any Rogue Amoeba apps you happen to have, that sort of thing, Sketch, now that they've gone out of the Mac App Store. So you'd be on your own for those, but anything that's installed from the Mac App Store, Apple would be able to do stuff with that. So it would be a good solution, not a complete solution, but it would definitely make things easier for users.
Yeah.
So the other really big thing in 9.3 is surprisingly for iPad, and what it is a full comprehensive education support package. So what they've done in 9.3 is they've added the Apple School Manager, which is a portal where teachers or administrators can create Apple IDs, purchase apps for devices, basically manage everything. There's a new classroom app where teachers can guide students. And specifically for classrooms, Apple has created a new brand of Apple ID called Managed Apple ID, which are Apple IDs that are created and assigned by the school. So essentially, a teacher or a principal can go into the Apple School Manager, create a classroom, and create Apple IDs for every child in that classroom.
That's great.
And it'll be a special Apple ID that is able to receive apps from the school manager. They'll be able to log in and it'll act like an Apple ID, but it'll be self-contained within the context of the school. And then this is the really cool part. iPad gains the ability for multiple students to use the same iPad. Shared login.
And multi-user access. Yes. It's inevitable.
So this is the big thing that people have been asking for iPad forever. And now suddenly in a point release, it's going to be available as a feature for this education initiative. So when you open an iPad and you're in a classroom, you're going to get, according to this, a view that basically says name of classroom and then a giant list with photos of every student in the classroom. And then you tap yourself and it logs into the iPad as you.
Yeah.
And there are some there's a lot of really neat little details in here that when I read them, I basically said, okay, iOS 10 is going to have a lot of this stuff in it. And we're basically getting a preview of what iOS 10 is going to be.
Well, that's what everyone's saying now. I think it's pretty obvious at this point.
It is pretty obvious.
They've been working on it for a while.
So the really big thing I noticed was this part. Students pick up where they left off. For students who use the same assigned iPad in a class each day, starting a lesson is hassle-free. Thanks to intelligent caching, when students log in, they don't have to wait for everything to download. It's already there.
That's a big deal.
So
it's huge.
Predictive caching for content and apps and whatever else. It's applied to consumer iOS. It's essentially a feature that means everything will be available exactly when you need it. Like it'll just magically predict, oh, you need these PDFs from iCloud Drive, or you need this, or you need that. It's hard to say exactly how it'll apply. It depends what they do with it, but it has massive commercial applications for the main iOS feature set.
Yeah. Do you think that teachers are going to be... Do you think it's going to catch their attention if it hasn't already? Like, do you think it's going to make a big impact?
I think it will. This set of features is essentially, it practically is the laundry list of things teachers have been asking Apple for years. It basically gives them everything they've ever wanted and more.
I know Fraser Spears is a big voice for this kind of stuff, I know, in the education space. I know he always blogs about this, and I know he podcasts about he's great. Like if anyone's interested, if anyone is in the education sector and they want to keep up to date on all the little things that Apple is doing as far as trying to improve the experience for rolling out technology, they should really listen to his podcast. I think it's on Relay FM. I can't remember the name of it. I'll put a link in the show notes, but it sounds like this is obviously been a long time coming, but you know, it's always easier said than done, and Apple wants to do it properly. It's just a matter of these are the first steps that they need to take in order to get this stuff done.
And with Apple, a lot of the time it's that they want to do something properly and it takes a bunch of steps to get there. So they might release feature after feature year over year that doesn't quite add up. You're like, okay, why did they add this here? But then eventually, after all the ducks are in a row, bam, there goes that feature that you've been wanting. And it was only possible because of all the other things they added over the past 2 or 3 years. So here's another major feature. See what your students see with screen view. Want to find out how a student is doing on a worksheet or equation? You can glance at any screen in your classroom with just a tap. Applied to enterprise, applied to commercial. Imagine a boardroom meeting and you can just share a report with everyone in the room. It's like AirPlay on steroids. It's basically turning every iOS device into a magic remote presentation platform. Because you can push content to anything in range, basically, which is nuts. And then here's the other part of it. Teachers can easily project any student's work on a classroom TV equipped with Apple TV. So a teacher can literally go, okay, show me what's on this student's screen and push it to the TV. So this is basically the AirPlay protocol at a whole new level. Like it's basically allowing you to see content on other devices, pull content from those devices and put it onto other devices. It's essentially reaching the level of seamless cross-device transfer that I've long been envisioning, where it's basically like I have this thing on one device and I literally just go whoosh, and it's instantly on the other device that I needed it on. So if they expand this protocol to include data transfer, for example, I can just be looking at a PDF on my iPhone and I can suddenly just go whoosh, and it's on my Mac full screen or on my Apple TV full screen or on somebody else's iPad full screen. Like it's AirPlay and AirDrop and all the other wireless technologies they've been building since iOS 7. And now it's fully matured and they can do all of these insane things with it. So, I mean, this kind of goes back to what I was just saying about how they release a feature and you're just like, whoa, this is crazy. But it took adding like two or three previous things to get to that point.
I'm just thinking internally what kind of debates and who had to fight for getting PDF syncing in iCloud working. Because I bet you that ticket has been sitting in their bug tracker for over a year. Since iCloud, how old is iCloud Drive now? It's over a year old, right? The app was released, what? Was it last year? I thought it was the year before.
The actual app was in iOS 9.
Right, but the CloudKit stuff, was that iOS 8?
CloudKit was iOS 8, I think. Yeah.
So, two revisions.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the cloud stuff, let's be honest, they're not so great with it. They need time to kind of get it right. But when they do get it right, it's amazing. iCloud Keychain is probably the greatest.
Yeah, I've never had an issue with it.
Auth sync, whatever. Like, I don't know how it works, but it's magic. Like, just now, I connected to your house Wi-Fi on my MacBook. And then in the span of a few seconds, my iPhone was suddenly connected as well. It just, like, that's...
Were you saying you didn't have to pull to refresh to make it sync?
No, I didn't.
You didn't shake the phone or do a little dance or anything like that?
It just sat there and did it by itself. So, it's the one cloud thing, Apple-related, that just works. So, I mean, they can get it right. It just takes them a while. Oh, yeah. This also ties into it. Launch and lock apps with remote control. Launch a specific app, website, or page in a textbook on every iPad in the class. So, again, pushing specific content to every device in the room. Saying, oh, I want to show you this thing. And it just appears magically. Let's see. Yeah, and then there's like a ton of management stuff that I think would cross over really well to enterprise. Like basically everything they announced for education would easily transfer to a company. Instead of a classroom, you have a division or a subset of the company. So yeah, that's really the big thing in iOS 9.3. And it has wide-reaching ramifications that won't fully be apparent until they announce iOS 10. I think iOS 10 for iPad is probably going to be particularly interesting because I think in iOS 10, we will see multi-user login. We will see...
A radically redesigned iPad OS?
It's possible. At the very least, we'll get multi-user...
I was joking.
I know. we might see a new springboard. I don't know. They might have had time to go, okay, the wall of icons doesn't really make sense anymore, especially on iPad Pro where it's ludicrously spaced out. Like, have you seen the springboard on iPad Pro?
Yeah, it's embarrassing.
It's ridiculous.
It's terrible.
So hopefully they've had enough time to think that through and go, okay, this doesn't really make sense anymore. How can we make this look better?
And the app switcher needs work.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a step in the right direction, for sure. I'd rather have it than not have it with the way it works with split view and multitasking.
Yeah, like I would almost like to see them implement something like Expose on OS X, where it's like, I can manage spaces, I can do all these things, I have all the apps, like, whoosh. And that would tie in really nicely to the new split view, because then I could actually have multiple spaces with more than one app.
Yeah, why,
running
why
side
don't
by
they
side.
Do spaces?
It would
basically
make sense.
That I mean,
it would make
like,
sense.
Like a four finger pinch or something to bring up like a quadrant.
Yeah.
That you could like tap on and say this is the virtual space I want to be in.
Yeah, and then you
it's
can
a big enough display.
And then if you swipe over, you can create a jump list of all the apps that are able to do split view, and yeah. then you can literally just drag them into a space, tap that space, pop it open. There you go. You've got your two apps running side by side. Then you can pop out, go into a different space with two apps running side by side. For iPad Pro, they might even introduce something crazy like four, or they might even bring in resizable windows. I don't know. Maybe not that, but something.
So did you hear that Italy is coming out of the dark ages now? I'm just kidding, Italy. We love you.
No. Yeah, that's pretty exciting. Apple has announced that they're opening an iOS development center in Italy, which is the first of its kind. I'm not sure exactly how it's going to work, but I think it's like if you want to develop iOS or learn to develop iOS, you go to this place, and I'm not sure if they have actual Apple engineers there or maybe Apple trained teachers, or I'm not sure what the deal is, but basically you go there and you have resources to be able to learn how to develop for iOS. And they've said it's the first of many. They will be opening more centers across Europe. And probably in North America, I would imagine. And what better way to manage those learning centers than iOS 9.3?
Indeed.
And then a surprise announcement of Xcode for iPad. Could you imagine Xcode for iPad Pro and suddenly...
That'll blow people's minds.
I know. Like, being able to develop iOS apps on iOS.
That's so meta.
Well, we develop OS X apps on OS X.
Well, I mean, it's not like the hardware wouldn't be able to do it. I mean, we're getting close to desktop class processing.
In fact,
power.
We are.
Well, we are at that with the iPad, right?
Yeah. AnandTech actually just reviewed the iPad Pro, and they found that the A9X chip in benchmarks beats the Core M in the MacBook 50% of the time.
That's
in
crazy.
50%
Wait,
of
MacBook,
the tests.
You're talking the one port wonder MacBook.
Yeah. Right. In 50% of the benchmark tests, the A9X chip in the iPad Pro beat the Intel Core M in the MacBook.
Wow.
So that's just this year. Imagine the next iPad Pro with the A10X chip.
Can't even fathom the processing power on that.
Yeah. So on a mobile chip, they're somehow managing to push out performance that beats a laptop-grade chip 50% of the time. So this is the same chip that's on the Surface Pro, devices like that. Not just the MacBook. It's kind of in a bunch of those like ultrabook devices. So to see a tablet approaching that level is just nuts.
Yeah.
And it's a testament to Apple's hardware development.
Well, it absolutely is. I mean, they've been honing that technology and the skills needed to make that silicon, but I think it goes without saying the software and the hardware integration, that is a massive advantage, right?
Oh yeah.
And you just can't beat that.
No, because they're able to essentially optimize iOS for the chips that they themselves design. So I mean, they can even design chips that are specifically optimized for the software. It doesn't even necessarily need to dovetail that the software is optimized for the hardware. They can optimize the hardware for the software because they make all of it. Like, they can add little chips that do specific things. Like with Siri, the A9 chip in the iPhone 6S has a special little audio subprocessor, which is how it's able to constantly listen for Hey Siri all the time. So, I mean, because they control that hardware design, they can basically go, okay, we want to do this in the software. Let's just add a thing to the chip. Boom, done. Like with Touch ID, they added the secure enclave to the chip. So it's not the first time they've done it, and it won't be the last time. I think overall this year is going to be pretty exciting. I know a lot of people have kind of been bummed out by Apple lately, kind of feeling like they're not doing as well as they have been in the past, that they've made missteps, that things are going wrong, the Apple is doomed crowd is getting louder. But I think ultimately this year is all about transition. It's about cleaning things up. It's about figuring out where they go from here. And not just on the products they already have, but the products they have yet to release or announce. And I think a big linchpin in all of this is Apple Campus 2. So they're working really hard to construct it. They've made huge strides, and I think it's going to be ready at the end of the year. Not sure exactly on the timing, but once it's built, it's essentially going to be where they build the next generation of Apple, where they design it, where they develop it. All of their future growth is essentially tied up in this building, because it's utterly massive and it's been designed specifically to allow Apple employees to collaborate. So they're essentially building a new space from which they can come up with what they're going to do next, more or less, and hire a bunch more people. Because
when is this thing going to be done? Because it's been in the works for years.
Yeah, I think it's going to be ready at the end of the year, if not quarter one 2017, at which point they'll be able to start moving people in. I think it's going to be really important for their growth, because just based on all the things that do exist and all the things that they're supposedly working on, they're going to need to grow as a company, like, big time. They're going to have to probably double their employees if they want to work on all the things they're supposedly working on. I mean, you've got iOS, you've got Apple TV, you've got Apple Watch, you've got Mac, you've got the car, you've got what may be some kind of virtual reality product, a bunch of health stuff related to the watch, not necessarily sensors that go on the watch. They might be working on smart bands. They might be working on additional sensors that you wear, HomeKit, smart home stuff. You've got the iCloud team. You've got the Siri team. You've got the Maps team.
Yeah, that's exhaustive. An exhaustive list for sure.
Like, there's so many things, and they're trying to add so many more things. So I think,
well, they absolutely will need to hire. There's no question.
Yeah,
there's no question. They need more people.
They absolutely need more people. So I think a lot of that is tied up in the construction of Campus 2, because in a lot of ways, it's kind of the next big Apple product.
Yeah,
because they've designed that place down to the square millimeter. Like, every single facet of that building has been designed by Johnny Ive. Every pane of rounded glass, every aluminum tabletop, everything.
It must be, I can only imagine how much, like, the immense amount of pleasure that he must get out of being able to design the building that they're going to be spending all of their time in.
Yeah. Imagine, you know, like, imagine what Johnny Ive's new design lab looks like.
To sit in a space where you can just look at it and think to yourself, "Wow, I designed this, and this place is like this was my dream. This is the place I've always wanted to work in." Which must be incredibly satisfying for him.
Oh yeah,
like, because you don't get that opportunity every day. I mean, he's not an industrial. I mean, well, he is, I guess, technically an industrial designer, but
yeah.
He's never done architecture, right?
No,
he's never done. I mean,
I think he's dabbled with it in the past, but I don't think he's done like an actual giant project like this. Yeah. No,
but I'm sure it must be stimulating to work on something that's sort of out of your wheelhouse. And in terms of,
I can't remember. I think they did hire an architect. I think they worked with Johnny Ive.
They would have to,
But ultimately, it's his vision, and everything that's in this new building is basically from him, including the giant auditorium right in the center of the ring surrounded by an apple orchard, because of course. So I think they're going to hold all future press conferences in that building. And from the conceptual drawings, it looks to basically be a giant glass cathedral to Apple.
Wow.
Like, it's this...
I haven't seen this. Have they released photos of this?
Like, there have been a few. Like, there was the time Steve Jobs unveiled it to the Cupertino City Council, because he had to, like, apply for the permit. So he had to, like, show all the concept drawings and everything and the blueprints. So I think what information we have is from that, and I think a few of the documents leaked when they submitted them to the city planner. So I think we mostly know what it's supposed to look like. I don't know if it's 100%, but yeah. The auditorium is basically going to be this giant, like, the outside of it is definitely glass. As for the inside, I'm not exactly sure. It could be like an Apple store where they have like a cylindrical glass staircase that descends into this beautifully designed, perfect acoustic chamber, or I don't know. But yeah, there's going to be an auditorium in the middle, and I think it seats like 5,000 people or something, like a sizable chunk. I don't think it'll be as big as Yerba Buena, but that might suit Apple just fine for regular press events. Not WWDC, but every time they announce an iPhone, they can probably do it on campus too if they wanted to. And then I think the building itself is like 3 or 4 stories. The whole thing is a circle. The entire outside of the building is panes of rounded glass, which they're only able to do because they did a ton of work on doing crazy glass stuff.
Yeah,
with
I'm
all
sure the
Apple stores
must have loved that. That must have been real fun.
Yeah, we want the entire outside of the building to be rounded glass.
Guys, nobody makes glass like that.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, nobody did, but I mean, a lot of the Apple stores,
can be done. It's
a lot of the
work.
Apple
it's
stores
expensive.
Have rounded glass and a bunch
of
other things.
Yeah, but on that scale though?
Oh yeah. Like the panels for the building, they're huge. They're really, really
huge.
Do you fly?
Do you helicopter that shit in? I mean,
I think they're using like mini cranes with like really, like it's wrapped in a ton of like netting and stuff to just very carefully place it.
I'd hate to be the person that has to Windex that.
Oh, yeah. Well, if they were smart, they'll be installing some sort of self-cleaning system.
Right. Can you imagine if somebody needs to, like, reprimand an employee, your duty is to Windex that one of those giant windows, but with a toothbrush?
Oh, God. Oh, man.
It'll be done next week.
There are actually photos of them installing the glass panes. They've started installing them now. And yeah, they are big. They are really, really big. I would not envy the person that has to do that. Hopefully nobody has to do that, but yeah. Scary. But I think the interior, they've designed like a bunch of crazy like open plan office space and the usual refinements and so on. Johnny Ive's design lab is probably like insane. He probably like designed this magical chamber with like countersunk built-in CNC machines in a row off to the corner where he can just be like, okay, build all the prototypes. Yeah. That room will probably be the coolest room in the entire building. Not just because prototypes of all future Apple devices are in there, but just probably because of how he designed it. Because, like, if he designed the whole building, like you said, he spends all of his time in that one room. So, of course, he would design it to be amazing.
Well, we wouldn't expect anything less.
No. Hell, they might even have secretly built a test track for the Apple car underneath. Because the whole thing's a circle. They could just have like a secret test track right underneath the building. And it just runs around. Or a particle accelerator. That would also work. they need to smash atoms to build the new type of aluminium for the iPhone. They have to make a new element. Lots of cool stuff happening. So
yeah, and actually,
the doomsayers, simmer down. Simmer down, people.
Yeah, but those people are always going to be around. Did you actually hear that IBM has acquired Ustream?
Mm, yeah, I did see something about that.
Why?
I really don't
know.
IBM, what they're doing.
Like, years ago, pivoted towards focusing on enterprise solutions and services.
Yeah.
But the purchase of a consumer streaming service,
it's odd. The only thing I can think of is that they're trying to deliver on some sort of telecommunication solution, like some kind of teleconferencing thing or something in that niche. I don't know exactly why they would need them. It seems like an acqui-hire to me. Like, they've hired the talent and they need to build something that's related to video. I don't know if it's necessarily streaming, but something about video.
I want to say IBM is irrelevant today, but I guess they're not, because they still seem to be making quite a bit of money from the enterprise stuff.
Oh, yeah. They still make quite a lot of money. And now that they've partnered with Apple, they're actually doing some really cool stuff.
What happened with Watson? That computer.
Watson is still around and very powerful and very awesome. And he's beginning to power a ton of consumer things.
Did Watson get together with Sherlock?
I don't know, maybe. So the latest round of Under Armour apps, they just released a new product at CES called the Under Armour Health Box. And it was a bunch of connected accessories like smart shoes and a heart rate bracelet and a few other things. But they connect to a bunch of apps that they just released. And those apps actually have health coach recommendations that are powered by Watson. So Watson will actually take your health data, crunch some numbers, and come back with, here are some things you could be doing to improve, which is nuts. So we're actually starting to see commercial applications for Watson, which is awesome. But as I've been speculating, the cooler thing could be Apple and IBM together, because...
Well, they've already started to formulate some kind of partnership, right?
Yeah. So in their strategic partnership, IBM has started offering Apple devices to enterprise along with IBM-developed iOS and OS X apps. They've made quite a lot of iPad apps, and they announced like how they were doing, and... There's this anecdote about how once a department at IBM switched over to using Mac, the number of support calls dropped by 40%. So, I mean, if that doesn't say something about how difficult PCs are.
Well, I mean, is it just naturally from all the combinations, all the possible combinations of hardware that you can have? I mean, that's just going to happen.
Oh, yeah. Especially with an operating system that can't possibly be optimized for all of those combinations. Like Windows, the best they can do is hope that you've got, an Intel processor or an AMD processor, and you have an AMD or NVIDIA GPU, and you have like a standard form of RAM and so on. Like, they can only make very generic assumptions about your hardware. So, of course, every driver for everything that you plug into your PC is going to be a generic driver. It's not a driver that's tailored to your specific thing. So, inevitably, there will be weird overlaps all over the place where stuff just breaks for no reason.
Yeah.
So... I mean, that's definitely one point in Apple's favor. They always know what their stuff is going to be running on, so you don't end up with issues like that, hence the 40% reduction in support calls. Because when you no longer have random blue screens of death or random driver errors or random this, you don't need to call about those things. The only things you need to call about are like, I can't get my document to print, or the usual. Like, it makes things a lot easier for IT, clearly.
Yeah, because, I mean, if anything, you would want, I would rather get the type of support request where they don't understand how to do something rather than something's horribly broken or there's a virus or there's malware. Yeah. And trying to get that shit off of the system is so frustrating.
Especially if it's gotten into the network. Well, then you're really screwed.
Sometimes things get so bad on Windows where you just have to wipe the whole drive and start again.
Oh, yeah.
And nobody wants to do that because that's a big waste of your time.
Yeah. Right. So IBM and Apple are really close now. So what I've been thinking is that at some point, Siri might actually get a helping hand from Watson. And Siri requests will actually have the capability of also making a request to Watson, depending on what you've asked. So that could be pretty interesting if they actually do it. I don't know if they will, but it's definitely a possibility. And of course, Apple on its own has been working on improving Siri.
Do you think that Siri would benefit from all of the Wolfram Alpha data? Like if it was, I don't remember exactly when they introduced this, but there was some level of integration where if you would ask something that was in Wolfram Alpha, that it would pull up in the results for Siri.
Yeah.
But not quite I'm wondering if Apple bought Wolfram Alpha, what they could actually do with that, what the potential would be.
Well, Wolfram Alpha isn't particularly smart. It's definitely a lot more clever than most things, but the limits of its power are that it's essentially a computational problem solver. Like, you give it a query that it understands and it returns an answer. So, as a really smart computer, it can do things like translate languages or tell you the square root of pi or tell you what date it will be 6 years, 3 months, 20 days and whatever and change, like what that date and time will be, things like that. Or what is the 23rd Monday of this year? Like, it can answer simple questions like that because it can parse your sentence and go, okay, this is what you're actually asking. Now I'm going to do some math or do something else and figure out the answer to your question. But it can only do that in very limited ways along certain pathways. Like, you can pretty easily trip it up. If you ask, like, what many would consider a fairly simple question, like, I don't know. I can't think of a good example right now. But
that's okay.
Even if it's a simple question, if you ask a question that's not inside its set of allowed questions, it easily gets tripped up. Like, for example, earlier this evening, we were discussing the word automagically, and yeah, we wanted to know what the etymology of it was. So I typed into Wolfram Alpha, when did the word automagically first appear? And it dropped most of that sentence and latched onto first appearance and assumed I was talking about fetal development, at which point it gave me a conception date picker, which was set to January 2nd, and then it came up with first appearance of eardrums and gave me a targeted birth date. So
if anyone is concerned that the machines are going to rise and take over humanity, you have nothing to be concerned because none of this stuff really works all that well.
Yeah.
There's so far to go.
Even machine learning isn't that great yet.
I want to talk a little bit more about machine learning because you and I, before we started recording, we were talking about quantum computing and the future potential for that. But I feel like there's like a hump that we need to get over, and yeah, I don't know if quantum computing is that breakthrough that we're waiting for.
I don't think it is. Really, the only benefit of quantum computing is that it can solve a particular subset of problems better than regular computers can. It's not this infinite problem solver that can answer any question in 1 second. Like it just doesn't work that way, unfortunately.
What about a hybrid between transistor computing and quantum computing? Isn't that something that we could maybe get the best of both worlds?
It's possible you could have a hybrid transistor and qubit processor. But the only problem is quantum computers currently need to be supercooled with liquid nitrogen in order to work. And they have to be in a complete vacuum. So
that's a problem.
The chip design for quantum computers is vastly different to traditional transistor chips. So in order to bridge that gap, we basically need to discover a room temperature superconductor, which we currently have not at all whatsoever. There are a few promising things, but so far nothing's panned out yet. They are still smashing atoms to find new elements, so fingers crossed. But until we find that magical element, it's going to have to be in a chilled vacuum box.
Well, if you're listening, Apple, have it on my desk by tomorrow at 5.
Yeah, I'm sure if they mine deeply enough, they will find it.
Indeed.
It would also make hoverboards work without liquid nitrogen, so that's cool too.
Yeah, what the hell is wrong with this trend of these companies calling these things hoverboards? They're not hoverboards. They don't hover at all.
At this point, I've stopped caring. I've really stopped caring. I don't care.
Driving me crazy.
Yes, it's technically a Segway without a handlebar thing, but whatever. I don't care. We don't have actual hoverboards, so if they want to call these stupid things hoverboards, let them. Let them melt and explode and make people fall on their noses or break their arms. I don't care. But real hoverboards, on the other hand, are pretty cool. But the only real hoverboards, they need liquid nitrogen, and they only work if every surface is made of metal. So there's that. Real hoverboards probably won't be a thing until we find some way of negating gravity, or at least
can't they just work on off the magnetism principle, like the maglev trains?
So in order to hover, on average, let's say a 220 pound man, to create a device that will make a man that weight hover in the air, like, let's say 6 inches, the amount of power you would need to generate a magnetic field to be able to do that.
They would need to build new lanes, like specifically for hoverboards, which is not going to happen.
Well, no. Basically, you could never fit that much energy into a portable device. It would be impossible.
Not yet. Well, until we miniaturize things.
Not yet, you say, but For the foreseeable future, it's impossible.
Right.
And there are several as yet completely unknown scientific breakthroughs that would be required to make it happen. Because we would need a room temperature superconductor. We would need some form of exotic matter that can generate an insane amount of power in like a drop. And have it not blow up in our faces or destroy reality or any of the fun things. It's basically a long list of things that would be required in order to make a real hoverboard.
Yeah.
So don't count on it.
You know, something occurred to me when we were talking about quantum computing earlier is I'm reminded of an episode of Star Trek Voyager. And I don't recall the exact season or what episode it was, but I remember it took place on the holodeck, and there was some kind of conversation in between Tom Paris and another character, and he was talking about, he mentioned transistor computing became completely obsolete, I think, in the 21st century or something like that, when they moved to isolinear chips, and what... What is the gel packs, the gel packs that,
bioneural
gel packs that is, but it does seem like we do need to, like, I don't know enough about quantum computing, but I feel like transistor technology is so old that to me, transistor technology feels like the internal combustion engine in comparison to how we now think of modern electric cars, that they're so vastly superior. Now, maybe quantum computing isn't that thing that we need, but it's clear to me that, like, in the way, way distant future, that at some point, like, transistor computing just will reach a plateau where we can't do anything.
We're already almost there. So,
well, we certainly, what is it, Moore's Law? We don't see that doubling of computing power.
Yeah, we do.
Do we?
Yeah, we do.
That's still...
It's still a thing.
But I don't see... Well, maybe it's just the way... But the thing is, maybe this is a marketing thing, but we don't actually see, like... We don't see an increase in gigahertz like we used to. You know,
no,
how, remember,
but
they would always
matter.
Advertise, like, last year we had, you know, 2 years ago we had 1 gigahertz chips, now we have 2 gigahertz. But... Now,
yeah,
like, we still
it's
have...
It's not judged on that metric anymore.
It's not judged
because now,
that
of
metric.
Course, we have multi-core and we have
all the other improvements that they've made internally, right?
Yeah. So we are running up against the limit of Moore's Law, and that limit is that once we hit 4 nanometers or so on a chip die fab...
What are we at right now?
Right now we're at 14.
So that's not that far off.
So no, we are running fairly close to the smallest die shrink we can make.
Do you know and offhand how often Intel does a die shrink?
Is every other year.
Every other year, okay.
So they release the brand new chip, then the next year they do a die shrink, which is basically
and then rinse and repeat.
The die shrink of that architecture.
Yeah.
They include a few new features, but it's not like a huge thing. Of course, Intel and other companies have run into severe delays on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, what is the next chipset that's supposed to be released by Intel that the new Macs are supposed to be based on? It's not Broadwell. It's,
no,
we have Broadwell.
Broadwell's
now.
Gone. The new
is it Ivy.
The new no
no.
The current one is Broadwell. The talk. Like the major revision before that was Haswell. Broadwell's the die shrink. Then the new chip design is Skylake.
Skylake right.
has been delayed a bunch of times. It's a 14 nanometer bulk silicon 3D transistor. And the next one is Kaby Lake.
And is that a die shrink? Is that, are they going down to 12?
No. They've changed their strategy. Kaby Lake is an upcoming 14 nanometer. It's still 14, and it's going to add some features like native USB 3.1 support, so USB-C.
Sure.
HDCP 2.2.
Are they breaking from that tradition of doing a die shrink? Have they run into limitations that maybe they didn't anticipate?
They've run into some production issues.
Because isn't it true when you go to the smaller and smaller the processes, isn't there like electrical leakage or something like that?
No. We haven't gotten to that yet. I was getting to that.
Okay.
So once we hit about 4 nanometers, if we try to go any smaller than that, we start to see what can essentially be described as quantum interference, because the at that point, the circuit pathways are so small that the electrons will jump from one to the other by accident, which will effectively render the chip useless.
Right.
So before we get to that point, we need to somehow come up with something new that'll enable us to make faster chips. And I have no idea what that is. One thing they've started doing is stacking things, creating 3D transistors. So that's like the new thing that they think will be good, where everything is kind of tiered up rather than across.
Has there been any talk as far as going away from transistor design completely, or is that way too radical?
There is some research being done in optical chips and a few other things. Nothing conclusive yet. Obviously, we still have time. Moore's Law is still true until we hit that point.
Well, at the rate they're going now, these issues are probably not going to be a problem for another 10 years or so.
Where is it?
Maybe more, actually. Maybe longer. If they're doing it every other year and they're at 14 nanometers now...
Cannon Lake is supposed to come out in 2017, and it's 10 nanometer. And Intel's actually not even sure how they're going to get to the next one, which is 7.
It'll take more than 10 years to get to 4 nanometers, but
yeah,
but it's not that far off.
Probably, but...
They need to be thinking about this stuff now.
Yeah, I mean, they already are, but...
Unless Apple puts more money and resources into chip development, actually ends up buying Intel, which I could see happening one day.
I don't know that they'd even want Intel because Apple is now the place to go for chip design.
Well, they're better.
They are.
Their chips are better.
So,
I thought the chips are though they're designing the architecture. Isn't Samsung still building them?
Yes.
So that's the next step for Apple is to get rid of them.
It's not just Samsung. Apple places orders with Samsung and another company, TSMC. Supposedly, TSMC has a contract for most of the A10 processors in the iPhone 7. They've actually reduced their dependence on Samsung, and rightly so.
But we all know that Apple is obsessed with owning every aspect of the manufacturing process. So you can just imagine
they're probably
trying to figure out, like, how can we get rid of these third parties? How can we do? Can we do it ourselves?
They can't. They just can't. They need Foxconn. They need these companies. Like they can't possibly make all of these parts by themselves. They just can't. It's impossible. Even if they threw all the money in the world at it, they would still have to open up shop in China,
sure,
hire all the people that Foxconn hires.
Thing is that Apple could buy realistically. Okay, so Apple could buy, Samsung's chip business or what was the other company?
TSMC.
TSMC. So they could buy them, but that just, all that means is that they now own that company and that company can't build those chips for anybody else, but they
already can't build Apple's designs for anyone else.
Sure.
Like that's all proprietary.
Right.
Like Samsung can't do anything with it.
Right.
Because if they did, then Apple would know right away and they'd be in really
Apple is coming up with those designs. So do they actually have people in the US in Cupertino designing that stuff?
Yes.
Okay. Because that I wasn't aware of.
They've poached a ton of people from AMD and Intel. Like, there was an anecdote a few months ago that was basically like, Apple is the place to go if you're at all excited about chip architecture.
I'm curious why they haven't delved into GPU design.
I think they're actually headed there this year. I think we'll actually see the first custom Apple GPU in the A10 chip.
You've got my attention.
For a while, they've been focusing on semi-custom power VR designs, but based on hiring patterns and based on how many people they have on that team now, I would say that the time is right for a fully custom Apple GPU design. I think it makes sense just based on the fact that they now have their own GPU pipeline in Metal. So optimizing around Metal would be a really important next step for that pipeline. Because then they can essentially build a GPU that's fully optimized around direct hardware access layers, which is going to be really important if they move OS X onto their own chips, because then they'll be able to optimize for that too. And I mean, really, given Apple's track record, it's inevitable, because right now they're using a design that somebody else makes for their GPUs, and we know what they do about that. So I think this year is probably the year. If not, then maybe next year with the A11. I mean, every passing
it's
year.
It's going to happen. I mean, it'll happen in baby steps, but it's going to happen.
Yeah. We will eventually see a custom Apple GPU.
And I'm sure that kind of stuff will make its way into their desktop line of products at some point.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think Apple really likes using Intel graphics?
God, no. I mean, look at what's happening with Skylake. It's been delayed multiple times now.
Right.
And Apple is essentially...
I mean, they're twiddling their thumbs waiting for another company.
Yeah. They
look at the Mac Pro. The Mac Pro hasn't been updated in, 2 years now?
Yeah. Exactly.
They're still on the 2013 Xeon chips.
And they probably have a new MacBook Pro that looks like the MacBook, all ready to go, but they need to put a Skylake in it. And they don't have Skylake because Intel's late again.
Yeah.
And this isn't the first time they've been late. Like, they've been late a bunch of times over the past 10 years. And those delays have led to delays on new Mac releases. So... if I'm Apple, I'm pissed. I am really mad with Intel because they continually keep pushing back their dates, which makes Mac release dates late, which lets down a bunch of customers. So Apple looks bad for not releasing a new Mac when they should, even though it's not their fault. So, I mean, that to me is one really big point of failure that Apple has to be looking to correct at some point. I mean, it would explain why they've ramped up development on the A-series chips as quickly as they have. Like, every single chip has been a major revision. They have not slowed down. Every single chip has been a massive leap forward in performance to the point where they're now beating Intel chips.
What do you actually think of the performance of the iPad Pro?
Well, I don't have one, so
but
I haven't.
Have you gone into an Apple store and played around with it?
I have. Yeah.
What do you think?
It's insane. It's completely insane. Drawing with the Apple Pencil.
I was impressed with that. Really impressed.
It's like a real pencil and paper, or it's close.
It
to
is
it.
Pretty close. I mean, it's by far. It's. I would definitely say it is better than good enough.
Yeah.
And yeah. That's a 1.0 product.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what next year, what this year's revision, they revise it, what they're going to do with that? Because the new, if they do, like come the fall of 2016, they'll have an iPad Pro 2, I imagine, with at least 3D Touch. That's the reason why I haven't bought a new iPad Pro.
Yeah, the new one will definitely have it.
I want the bigger screen, but I don't want to get it without that forward-thinking stuff that they put into the 6S.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what happens. I think the next iPad that's going to come out is the iPad Air 3, which is in development. I don't know when it's going to be ready. It might be ready in time for the March event.
Yeah.
But it might not. If it's not, then they might announce it at WWDC. And my guess is that it will also support the Apple Pencil.
Yeah.
It'll basically be an iPad Pro Mini.
Yeah, and speaking of Apple events, it seems like it's, you know, the speculation that's been happening, I think, for over a year now about Apple basically taking the iPhone 5S design and gutting it and updating the internals. And it seems like if the rumors are true and what Mark Gurman is reporting about the revised design is that they're going above and beyond just replacing the guts, but they're actually rounding the corners of the iPhone 5, which is not something I expected them to do. If it is true, because obviously this is still rumor territory.
It is true, though I'm not exactly sure how it's going to play out. The way he described it is really odd to me.
Wasn't there a mock-up or a picture
there
or something?
There was. That mock-up assumed it's going to look like the iPhone 6, though.
Right.
In Gurman's description, he basically suggests that it looks exactly like an iPhone 5S, except the glass is now curved and it perfectly molds to the antenna, which to me sounds like a OnePlus X, I don't know if you've seen the OnePlus X.
I have, not in person, but I've seen it in photos. But they would still have to get rid of the chamfered edges,
yeah,
wouldn't they?
Yeah.
To make that happen.
Yeah, so on the OnePlus X.
So then wouldn't it look like an iPhone 6 if they did that? How could you do the curved design without that, without making it look like an iPhone 6?
By keeping the flat antenna design. So just imagine the 5S with the flat, rounded antenna.
Yes.
And then put curved glass on the front that perfectly lines up to just the top edge of that antenna.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah.
So it would have to be slightly rounded, but it wouldn't be as rounded as the iPhone 6.
No, because the iPhone 6 design is completely rounded all the way around.
So I definitely on the bottom, it probably won't be rounded, just the top
part. At least, that's the way he seems to be describing it. I don't know if that's actually the case.
Now, if
because he didn't
assuming
elaborate.
Assuming this is true, let's say Apple does do that. Why do you think they would want to do that on that old design? Why go back and retool their machine to make that curved display?
I feel like this iPhone is essentially an experiment, just like the 5C was. Only this time, instead of trying to make a cheap iPhone that is cheap, they're trying to cobble together an assemblage of parts from old current iPhones at a particular time in the supply chain when those parts are at their cheapest. Because think about it this way. When this iPhone is announced, it'll be March, 6 months from the release of the iPhone 7.
Right.
When the iPhone 7 is released, the iPhone 5S is dead, gone, destroyed. You can never buy one again. The iPhone 6 is at end of life. They only make a few of them, and it's the $0 phone. And the iPhone 6S is last year's model that they sell for $199 or $99. At that point, the economy of scale has worked its magic, and the parts for the 6 and the 6S are now extremely cheap to manufacture because the 6, they've been manufacturing for 2 years now. And the 6S, they've been manufacturing for a year.
Yeah, I see where you're going with this.
So at this point, in this timing, to use the parts from the iPhone 6 inside and the modem from the 6S, I'll get to that in a second. I think that's an interesting point. And then to just create a new custom chassis around it, it's going to be a lot cheaper than anything else they could do. Like they're basically trying to use their supply chain to their advantage by pulling in different things that are really cheap to make now and use them to create a brand new phone so that it feels like the high-end experience that Apple customers are used to, but it relies on cheap components that they've been making for a long time now.
Because and to be clear, because I think cheap has a negative connotation, but you're talking about good quality hardware, but is now just inexpensive because the passage of time and because they've made so many of them. Yeah. They have the machines to do it. Everything's tooled up, ready to go. And the cost of those parts have gone down over time. So now they're able to build a less expensive iPhone, but in Apple's eyes, not compromising on the quality, which has been the biggest reason why I think they haven't done this stuff before. Because, you know, of course, people are claiming, why doesn't Apple make an inexpensive phone like Android phones? You can buy them $50 Android phones. Well, yes, Apple could do that, but they don't want to. They don't want to compromise on the quality of their product. And you don't have to agree with that, but it nonetheless, it is a perfectly valid reason not to do it. You're not that customer. You're not Apple's customer if that's what you want, which is fine.
Yeah. My pet theory is that that's why the 5C failed, because here was a phone.
Did it, though?
It's hard to say. They never released exact numbers for it, but I don't think it sold that well because we didn't see a 6C. We didn't see a 6SC. So it
was... But the 5C is unapologetically plastic.
So what I think happened was it really didn't do well. And the reason I think it didn't do well is because they created an experience that was visually and aesthetically subpar compared to the other phones in the lineup. Here are all these shiny metal phones that look amazing. And here, have a plastic one.
Like, I think it was a good experiment.
It's
though.
A good experiment, but the optics on it were all wrong. Their intentions were good, but ultimately they created a phone that nobody looking at that lineup would want. Because you put,
although you know, you a, put lot, a, plastic I know phone, a lot of people like the color choices,
yeah.
Which I still think is an issue.
I mean,
they've made some effort to introduce, you know, a gold and a rose gold phone, but I still think more color options would be great.
Yeah. And there are a few other options they could do. They could do some kind of like cobalt blue option.
I would love potentially. That. I would love that. Or a red.
I know you like red, but
I
would love a product red iPhone. That would be amazing. But only if it has a black screen. If it has a white screen, no. Goodbye. Yeah. So with this phone, I think they've taken a step back and said, okay, we can do a cheap phone, but it has to look as good as the other phones in the lineup. You have to be able to place it next to an iPhone 6S and an iPhone 7 and be able to say, this is still a good experience. You will not lose out buying this phone.
Yeah, we don't want a product that has to be relegated to the back counter where the iPod Nanos are.
Yeah.
Which nobody gives a shit about.
Exactly. Like that is essentially the raison d'etre for creating this phone. It has to match up with the other phones in the lineup so that people don't feel left out, so that people don't feel like they've been cheated somehow.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more with that.
So, and this brings me to the interesting part about this phone. According to Gurman, it has the iPhone 6 internals, but it has the iPhone 6S modem chips.
Yes, I did see that.
It has Bluetooth 4.2, 802.11 AC Wi-Fi, and
better LTE,
VoLTE.
Yeah.
Voice over LTE. So, again, Apple never does anything by accident. I think there is a very deliberate reason they included those parts instead of just slapping on the iPhone 6 modem.
Yeah. Michael, did you know if you buy the iPhone battery case, you get a free iPhone 4S inside?
It's about that big.
Wish I had a soundboard. I would have put a rim shot in there.
So I think the reason they included it is probably either the Wi-Fi or the Bluetooth. And the reason for that is some as yet unannounced product will require Bluetooth 4.2.
You don't say.
Or Wi-Fi, AC Wi-Fi.
I hear BTLE 4.2 is much better for audio.
Yes, it is. So
Apple couldn't possibly care about the quality of audio that comes out of their phones, could they?
Out of wireless devices, I can't imagine why they would do such a thing.
Who cares if your music takes, you know, 4 seconds to pause?
Yeah, you know? That's fine. That's just fine. So what I'm alluding to is the iPhone 7 is going to kill the headphone jack.
What?
Yeah.
This is the first time I'm hearing about this.
Yeah, I've never mentioned this before. So it's now looking increasingly likely that this is going to happen, based on information from Gurman and leaked, I'm not sure what it was. It's like a cache file found in iOS 9.3, basically saying has, headphone output false. Like this little snippet that's like, it's what they normally put to tell iOS apps if a phone has certain capabilities or not.
Yeah, like you know that old expression, where there's smoke, there's fire?
Yeah,
there's just way too much information floating around
there is.
About this.
So that kind of flag is something that's used in iOS to tell developers what capabilities a phone has or doesn't have. So if there's a new flag called has headphone output, that means there's going to be a phone that doesn't have headphone output, meaning a phone with no headphone jack, meaning the iPhone 7 won't have a headphone jack.
I just can't wait to see how people are going to flip out when this product
they're gonna
is out.
Flip out. Well, the tech people will flip out spectacularly. Regular people will go, oh, there's wireless earbuds in the box. No big deal. Whatever. Cool. And that'll be that.
Well, like, I can just see there are certain people, and I imagine there are going to be certain, you know, extremist Android fans. They're going to be like, another cash grab by Apple. Why don't you just buy an Android phone? Because you get a choice until a year or two down the road where everybody moves complete digital signals for audio. Because honestly, the fact that you have to have an analog to digital converter means that can have an impact on the quality of your audio. And why not just get rid of the converter and go with a pure digital
cut
signal?
Out the middleman.
Exactly.
Yeah, of course. And it's inevitable that all the other phones will do it, because once Apple does something and goes, this is the future now, everyone follows suit, whether you like it or not.
It's going to happen. It's going to happen, people.
Just like, what happened to the floppy drive? Oh, what happened to the CD drive? Oh, right. Apple got rid of them, and then everyone else did.
I know it'll take a long, long time, but it would kind of be nice to see that trickle down into the professional audio space.
I think it will. I think just because of the way things are moving to higher and higher bit rate, higher and higher quality, like, and with Bluetooth 4.2 and all of these other things happening.
Well, professional audio gear for a while now has supported higher resolutions. Like, you can buy pro audio equipment, you know, audio interfaces that can actually record all the way up to 24-bit 192. Like, so it's like, you know, we're talking very high sampling, very high resolution, capturing that level of sound. I mean, it only makes sense for me that we get rid of the analog, a lot of the analog signals, you know, and go with, I mean, I would love it if pro audio gear just had like a lightning port and you can just plug in your lightning headphones, you know?
Yeah. I think that'll basically be the solution for really high-end stuff.
Well, the thing is, there's a whole freaking market of headphone amplifiers, of super, super expensive headphone amps.
Yeah.
So it does stand to reason that we can improve the DACs that are included in a lot of audio gear, whether it's consumer or professional. So, you know, like I said, it's going to take a long time for everybody to switch over, but I think it's going to happen at some point.
Yeah. The only question is whether Apple decides to do like proprietary crap.
I can't see them doing that, because I don't think, like, if they want mass adoption, I don't think that would work.
Yeah, like that.
Like
that's
Lightning,
the big problem.
Lightning isn't proprietary, is it? To
it,
Apple,
like it they, is. Yes,
but you have to pay a licensing fee though.
Yeah,
in order to use it.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
And it'll only work with Apple stuff. And
I don't know. It maybe if all of this stuff, like, eventually if Lightning gets phased out, maybe there will be a more miniaturized version of USB-C, where now everybody moves to USB-C.
That is where I think we're going. People really won't like Apple if they do this, but I feel like it's going to happen.
No, it's okay. People don't like Apple.
I know. Actually, no, maybe not. Maybe they won't have to do anything, because they are part of the USB-C working group.
Yes, that I'm
so
aware of.
So they do help decide what USB-C is. So what I'm thinking is going to happen is they're going to go, hey, we'd really like to use USB-C, but the port is kind of big. Why don't we use this other port we made that's really small and totally reversible, just like USB-C, and it has the exact same spec, more or less? why don't we use that? And then USB-C becomes Lightning. And all they have to do is change the little microprocessor in the port. And there you go. Lightning port becomes USB-C port, which looks exactly the same as Lightning port. And all the old cables still work with it.
I think Apple is only partial to a technology, even if they've only, even if they've invented it themselves. I think they're partial only to it so far as long as it suits their needs. And the moment that that becomes an inefficient thing or a block, they get rid of it. And if it means that the new micro, like miniaturized USB C standard is the better solution, I don't think Apple will have any qualms about selecting that as the,
Absolutely not.
The successor to
Lightning.
Absolutely
not. I honestly don't know why we stuck with 30-pin for as long as we did.
That remains a mystery to me.
Like, they could have made Lightning at least 2 or 3 years before they actually did. So I'm not sure what they were waiting on, but I think ideally they would like to change USB-C to just be Lightning, essentially, and then they don't have to do anything, at least not user-facing.
Yeah.
Like, to a user, the Lightning cables will still work. You'll just have to get, like, a new USB-C cable if you want to do anything special that requires it. But the old cables will still charge your phone and all that good stuff.
Well, I remember when we switched from the 30-pin connector to Lightning, everybody was so pissed off and people were saying, this is a cash grab. They just want to sell accessories. But then after a few months went by and people started buying these iPhones, and then they realized, whoa, it's reversible. You mean I don't have to actually think which way it actually goes in? Wow. This is the best thing since sliced bread.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Even if they have to change it, it'll be fine. if they do Lightning and force people to make Lightning headphones, then there's going to be headphones that only work with Apple, and that's not really an ideal situation. So if they have to switch to USB-C so that we can have USB-C headphones that work with everything, they're going to do it. Especially since USB-C is now also the same port as Thunderbolt 3. So, again, going back to that one port to rule them all, you can have, at that point, iPhones and Macs that all use the same port.
I'd like to see a new Mac Pro. Sorry, not Mac Pro. I would like to see a new Mac Pro, but I would like to see a new MacBook Pro with at least 2 USB-C ports. That would be awesome.
Yeah. We'll have to wait till Skylake comes out for that.
Come on, Intel. Come on.
You can do it. We believe in you. Yeah.
You're listening to The Impromptu. I'm here with Michael Norton, as always. And if you'd like to show your support for the show, there are a few ways you can do that. I'd invite you to visit hologramradio.org/sponsors. We've got some Amazon links set up for you fine folks. And of course, we all know you like to shop at Amazon, as do we, because retail's kind of a bag of hurt these days. But click on one of those links. We've got Amazon UK, US, and Canada, and when you click on them, it's the exact same shopping experience you know and love. No additional work on your part, except Michael and I will get a portion of each sale, which helps us out greatly to cover things like infrastructure, as far as the cost for our servers, audio equipment, which is incredibly, ridiculously expensive here, and all that good stuff. You can also go to our donations page and fork over a buck or two or more if you're feeling generous, which would be greatly appreciated. And why don't you take a moment and head up to iTunes and leave us a review. It's been quite some time, folks, since we've had one, and I know we have some new listeners, so it would be great to hear from you. It only takes about 30 seconds to leave a review, so why don't you go and do that? It not only helps us, makes us feel good, but it helps new people discover the show, which is something that we would always welcome as well. If you'd like to get in touch with either Michael or I, you can drop us a note at theimpromptu@hologramradio.org. That's theimpromptu@hologramradio.org. You can hit us up on Twitter @theimpromptu as well. Or if you want to find out about all the great podcasts podcasts on our network. You can also go to the Hologram Radio Twitter account and check that out as well. Follow us everywhere, which would be great. Well, that's it for this week.
So, thanks for listening. See you next time.